Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Dana Spioda. Spioda is an assistant professor of English at Syracuse University, where she teaches in the highly acclaimed creative writing department. She is author of three novels, including her first called Eat the Document. It was a National Book Award finalist and won the Rosenthal Foundation Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her most recent is called Stone Arabia, which was named one of the 100 notable books of 2011 by the New York Times and is a finalist in the National Book Critics Circle Awards. Stone Arabia was published by Scribner's. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, did you always know you would end up being a writer? Tell us about your beginnings with this profession.
Well, I knew I wanted to do something with writing, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to make movies or write novels. So I grew up in Los Angeles, and I always loved movies as well. So I wrote some screenplays as well, and I wrote some songs too, and also I was writing stories. So
that's
it was all
a real LA story, isn't
yeah.
it?
But I realized that if I want, I think the novels won out because I wanted to be able to just do it all on my own and not have somebody give me money to do it. So I like the idea that you could just be in a room with a pen and paper, or now a computer, and you would have you could reach full completion, which is kind of ties into the book, because I was thinking about this idea of what it means to be an artist and whether you need an audience or not, and how to get satisfaction out of creativity.
Yeah. Well, you said, I saw something on your biography. It says you think a novelist should go to the culture's dark places and poke around. why the dark places? Do you think they're more authentic?
Well, I think of the novel, because I think the novel is kind of an off-kilter thing. It's not the center of the culture. It's slightly marginalized, that I think it kind of gives it a subversive point of view, that the novelist can go sort of the places that other people don't explore. It's less mainstream. It's about a long look at something. And I think a lot of things in the culture about quick looks, about sort of reducing things to black and white, you know, sort of figure it out really short, punchy things. And a novel is about a long look, a long concentration, making things more complicated, not making them simpler. So I start with a question and I think about how can I really make it as complicated as it really, really is. And that's interesting to me because I don't think there are many places in the culture where you're allowed to sort of make things more complicated.
Yeah.
Sort of this the other direction.
And explore something in depth, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you're
exactly
right about this culture where everybody just wants a 5-minute fix.
Exactly.
Quick, let's go to the next news
bullet
story.
Points.
Exactly.
You know?
Now, you seem to be exploring people who stay hidden or become hidden. I mean, in Eat the Document, the protagonist, Mary, was forced underground. And in this current book, the rock star, the main character in it, the musician, keeps his work hidden from the world.
Mm.
To tell us why you're attracted to people who pretty much stay hidden.
I don't know the answer to that. I do think writing and being a novelist is a kind of having a secret life. You have this secret project that you're working on, and I think because you need to kind of invent a world, you are cryptic about it, you are secretive about it, you protect it, and it almost feels like a double life in a sense. You go to your thing in the morning and you add to it, and then you live your life. You teach or you see your kid or whatever, and they're sort of compartmentalized. And so I think I am attracted to characters who have double lives or have
secret lives,
because I think
yeah.
that's the way I live with my own creativity. It has to be sort of protected because you add to it every day, but it has to be its own contained world.
Uh-huh.
You can't let it get distracted or dissipated.
But as a novelist, your work ends up going out in the world.
That's
your
true.
Characters stay hidden, most of them.
Eventually,
I find that really interesting. Exactly.
Exposed.
But what does that tell you about this culture, though, that people have to hide out? Is it particular to this culture, do you think?
I think it's, in some ways, it's easier to hide out than it used to be because with the internet, there are more places to find other like-minded people where you can have subgroups
uh-huh.
and connect in secret ways.
Yeah, and you can make comments.
You can never leave your house,
right.
really.
You can make comments without people knowing who you are.
Right, you can exist. And I think there's interesting things about that. Most things that I think are interesting and important have dark sides to them and also great upsides. So I'm very interested in thinking about that. So my relationship to technology is very skeptical but fascinated by technology. So I'm always trying to think, well, how is this changing our life? What is it really, how does it play out in our daily lives? Does it change who we are? So I think there's a part of me that's very interested in the cultural moment and how the things in the cultural moment shape us and some parts of us don't change. We obviously were always scared of dying, and we're always, you know, there's these things that human beings have always experienced, but they come out in different ways based on sort of the cultural moment, I think, or it's expressed in different ways. And so I like trying to put my finger on that.
Well, tell us about the two main characters in Stone Arabia. They're fascinating. They're brother and sister. Tell us.
Okay, so they're brother and sister. They're approaching 50. And they've grown up in Los Angeles, and they really have never had any money. They were very marginal lives. And the brother was a musician and had a brief moment where he was sort of successful in the L.A. scene, and then it fizzled out, and he just kept making music on his own. And he created a 30-year private art project, which consists of records, CDs, then CDs that he made and recorded, but album art, and then a whole bunch of ephemera related to that, everything from fake interviews with himself to a whole fantasy life that he's created with these chronicles, which are scrapbooks and all sorts of things. And almost like an outsider art project. And his sister has really been his audience and supported him, and he also bartended to support himself. And now that they're approaching middle age, the sort of things are falling apart. They're getting older, his health is falling apart, their mother is losing her memory, and the daughter, Denise, the sister, is kind of holding it all together, holding her brother together, holding her mother together. And she has a daughter who's making a movie about
her uncle,
Nick, about the brother. Mm-hmm. And that sort of is the catalyst for some of these fissures to really explode, I think. So I was kind of interested in this year where sort of everything falls apart. Because usually that's when you find out who people are, when
the tensions come upon people, indeed, and stresses.
The classic thing that in a creative writing class that you hear from teachers is put your character in jeopardy. And the reason why is I think human beings when you find out what breaks them, that's when you find out who they are.
Yeah, well, you call this a coming of middle age story, which which is really kind of depressing if it's true. I mean, these people seem pretty extreme. You know what I find interesting, too? The fact that you have this Nick character, this musician, hiding in an era when everybody wants to be on American Idol.
Right.
And everybody wants their 5 minutes, and these talentless people are out there having reality shows.
Right.
So what? Why did you do that?
Well, I think that the character Nick is very ambivalent about fame. I think he likes control. I think he wants to control the whole thing. So I don't think he was that interested in reception at a certain point, or very limited reception. His sister, his niece, his few ex-girlfriends.
Few friends, yeah.
I think if fame came knocking, he probably would have said yes, but it didn't, and I didn't think he was going to fight for it. And I think he decided that he was going to make a life anyway. And I admired that about him. I think in some ways the character is kind of this narcissistic person, and you sort of think I think people react differently to him. But I admire the fact that he has found a way to be his own person in the world and not care what other people think. And I think ultimately every artist really wants to keep in touch with a part of you that just doesn't care what other people think, because that's sort of a purity there.
Uh-huh.
But I also think putting it out into the world and getting reception is really important. And I think Denise is more engaged in the world, and she has to deal with the realities of the world, and she isn't in retreat the way Nick is.
Would you call her a co? Co-ing his kind of dysfunctional life? Call her that?
I think they both enable each other to be. I think that's the way families work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that she gets a lot out of his freedom of expression, and he gets a lot out of her reception. I think she gets a lot out of his music and about being. I mean, one of the things I was really interested in the book was in what you get out of music and art versus what you get out of, say, the news or media or noise.
Uh-huh,
so I think with Denise, she has this thing where she's interested in her brother's music, and she's interested in you know, one thing really deeply, that she knows his music really well, and that gives her a lot. But she also becomes overwhelmed with the internet and with watching cable news, which is maybe not very soul-supporting.
Uh-huh.
So I think there's a difference between, you know, as I don't want to say the word consumer, because that's exactly the wrong word, but as a responder, you can respond to something that is sustaining and gives you something, art, ideally,
or
something that sucks it out of you, which I think is what I would call this sort of cable news thing that she gets sucked up into.
And so many people are.
Yeah.
So many people are sucked into that stuff. They don't realize that their soul is being being destroyed by it.
It's addictive. It's strange. I mean, I had this experience. My mother will probably not appreciate me saying this, but she actually wouldn't mind. But I would. She watches a lot of cable news, and I would call her up, and she'd say, "Did you see what happened?" And it was almost as if it had happened to her. And I'd say, "No, I didn't know that that dog was caught on an ice floe or whatever trauma you've just been watching for 3 hours." And of course, I've experienced it myself. You know, when 9/11 happened, and we were all watching TV for 3 days.
It did become like a community, didn't it?
All of us. It was a strange sense of community, but it was odd too. You know, it's a hard thing to understand, and because there isn't any, the way that things come and then disappear, is very strange too.
And that's why people like Facebook, because things disappear. They keep scrolling along.
So the past is still with you, so you can still go back. it's very strange, and I think all these things have great potential, and all of them have. You know, I think tap into weird things in our human in our human experience that we haven't quite figured out yet.
Yeah.
We dive in, and we all have 24-hour internet on our cell phones and whatever. And then
constant
later
access.
On, we find out that it's changed the way we form memories, or it's changed the way we communicate, or whatever.
It is scary to me.
You know, and so I'm very interested in that in the book, and just thinking about. And I think Nick is kind of the anti-internet in a way, because he is so he is in such isolation, but he also has created his own internet.
And it keeps him creative, though. It keeps him so creative. He doesn't just make music; he designs the covers.
Yeah,
and that reminded me of the 60s when they really were creative.
Yeah.
Like album covers. You know, real artists like Peter Max would be designing them.
Right.
So the fact that he's not involved in high tech makes him more creative in some ways. I mean, did you see yourself saying that?
Oh, yeah.
That high tech is keeping us away from art?
Well, luckily, to be a novelist, you can have characters say things and you can throw it out there and say, Nick is a cut and paste, glitter and glue guy. He's not interested in the internet.
That's what you
but
did, yeah.
But Ada is all about the internet. The daughter, the daughter of the sister, his niece, who's making the movie, she's got her blog, and she's, and in a way, she's more equipped to deal with the world. It's the person who's sort of, Denise is kind of in the middle.
She is.
She's the one who's the least equipped, and I kind of relate to that, too, because I have such ambivalence, and yet I use all of it. You know, I do. I mean, I don't use Twitter, but I mean, I am the least, probably the worst user of Facebook on the planet. Because I just lurk around. I never post anything. I can't quite get off. I know. It's horrible.
So you are creating characters based in part on your life. Tell us why Stone Arabia takes place in 2004. Why did you pick that particular
year? Very interesting question. Well, because it was, as I said, I'm very interested in the cultural moment. And so what time period the book in is placed in is important. And that was with Abu Ghraib was one of the things that really... watching that on the news and pursuing it was a really traumatic experience for me. So that was why I knew that would be in the book somewhere, that would be one of the things that you would be exposed to. And that 2004 was a horrible year to be an American. It was just a year of despair for me from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And so that seemed to be the right year.
It was a year into the war, too.
And the wars. Mm-hmm. And it was the year, and then the Beslan massacre. I mean, it's one of these years where there were just endless terrible things on the news. So that was one reason. And it was really, I wanted to be a recent enough past where I could talk about some of these technology issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to write about this moment. So at least a few years so you can get some perspective was important. But I still wanted to be recognizably sort of the issues that we have now.
So you say in your biography that you do a lot of research for all your books and you love doing research.
I do.
But so how do you decide to hone in on, I mean, there's so many cultural and political contexts going on at a given period of time. What makes you decide to talk about Abu Ghraib instead of like the music scene that year?
Right.
You know?
Right. It's hard to say. I mean, I think, it depends on the book, but I think that a lot of it is intuition and instinct, and a lot of it is wasted time. I mean, not wasted time, but I do go down a lot of alleys that don't produce anything, that don't end up in the book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Dana Spioda. We're talking about her book, Stone Arabia. Now, Nick and his sister are coming of age in L.A. Is this based on somewhat on what your experience was, too?
Well, they're older than
that. Or you were gone by then.
Yeah, they're old. They're different. They're a different generation. One, I mean, not that much of a difference. I came of age in the 80s in Los Angeles, so it's a little bit later They're sort of the 70s. But
you get the feel for LA, no matter when you were there.
Yeah.
I can attest to that.
Definitely. And I'm very interested in Los Angeles as a place. I think one of those things, because I had so many important years there, and I would go back and visit my parents, I have enough distance, I have a kind of exile from Los Angeles that it just seems my imagination always finds subject matter there. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I just always find that I am far enough away from it, but it's still very vivid to me.
Mm-hmm. And well, you're also probably like Nick. You don't care what people think, because if you do, it's hard to live in L.A.
No? Maybe that's it. Los Angeles does seem to be America. I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but I think it's true. It is sort of American tendency writ large, right? You do have everything extreme there. It doesn't feel as weighted by Europe as the East Coast. It doesn't seem to have that same history.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I do love the architecture, the 20th century architecture of Los Angeles. I love all the signage. I love the part. I love Hollywood.
Oh,
I love
old
movies.
Hollywood is gorgeous.
Yeah, and I love the music. I love the history of Los Angeles and the music scene. And then all the sort of crazy apocalyptic LA stuff is great, you know, as long as you don't have to be in it. Yeah.
from there to upstate New York, why did you name the book Stone Arabia? I know it's based on a real town and mainly Amish inhabited.
Yeah. Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, again, a lot of this is, I really wanted Denise to kind of find her the opposite place to Los Angeles in a way. I really needed her to leave, physically just leave and go somewhere else and reach out into the world beyond all the stuff that's coming at her. And I had driven by, I had heard the name Stone Arabia and I always thought it was a beautiful name, sort of mysterious. Why is it called this?
It is.
And then I drove through it one day and it was astonishingly beautiful in this austere upstate New York kind of.
Well, where is it actually?
It's north of Canajoharie in Montgomery County. So it is, I guess, it's east of here and then you go north about half an hour.
Okay.
So if you go on 20, just go north. And it was maybe an hour north. And it's very, very, you can see sort of the Adirondacks. You can see it just is a gorgeous farmland kind of. Only people who really are tough people would live there.
So did you see this as kind of a clearing for Denise?
Yeah.
You know, kind of a place for her to aspire to?
It's not Santa Monica.
Or Los Angeles proper,
it's not the
right?
It's suburbs. It's, as I said, it has this austerity. It has a kind of purity. And obviously, you know, and it attracts all sorts of interesting back to the landers. You know, I think upstate New York has this, and it came up, I read about it in Eat the Document as well, that she goes to a commune that's in upstate New York. And I do love that central New York and upstate New York has this history of everything from, you know, Christian alternative communities in the 19th century to
the Amish,
70s return to lands, and now Amish. I mean, it's just constantly taking people from the fringe. And I think there's just a lot of space up here to be on your own, in your own world.
That's
and that's
a discreet way of saying on your own.
You can be eccentric.
And into interesting communities, for
nobody's going to bug you.
You know what I find in this day and age? There are a lot of ways for musicians to record music, whether they have talent or not. And, you know, it's good and bad that people can express themselves. But you make it pretty clear in this book that Nick is talented.
Yeah.
And was that an important factor?
Well, I mean, so I tried to be, I do believe that he, I think Denise thinks he's very talented, and I think he probably is, but I also don't know how important that is, really.
Oh, okay.
Because I kind of think that the idea of just being creative and not being sucked into, we do have this feeling that in the culture that you need to make money at something for it to be worthwhile.
That's right.
And, you know, it's kind of a consumer model that gets applied to art. And if somebody isn't paying you to do it, then you must not be doing something worthwhile.
And if somebody does pay you, you must be good. And that's not always true either, right?
And we know that's not true.
Right, right.
He's definitely a resistor to that. And I think that gesture alone I give him marks for that. And I do think that part of it is just the long elaboration of a secret art project is always interesting because people are just so interesting in isolation. they go off, they create their own world, and it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think a lot of the outsider artists, you know, people who are the postmen during the day and at night, they do their secret project. It's almost always fascinating. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, some of it's mental illness, but some of it is just isolation, creativity and isolation, the human spirit that just doesn't get interfered with, just goes in interesting places.
I know, and it seems like Nick embodied a realistic world, too, because he was even writing bad reviews for some of his stuff. I thought that was really fascinating.
I think he tries to give himself some integrity. I don't think he wants to just be in a fantasy world. He wants to make it a real world of which he is entirely in control. So he does write bad reviews. I mean, some of it's, he's almost his own worst enemy in a sense. He satirizes himself. He makes fun of himself. He makes a lot of jokes at his own expense. He's not crazy. He's fully aware of how out there he is. And he doesn't have any responsibilities. He doesn't have any kids. He doesn't have any of these. So, you know, he kind of said, I'm going to do my own thing and pay my own price. The trouble is, of course, that he does have a sister. He does have a family. And when he starts to fall apart physically and can't take care of himself, it does have consequences.
That's right.
People who love him have to watch him fall apart. And so you can't really be isolated. That's another thing in the book, is that there's no such thing as, no person is an island. It's true.
It is true. He still has to be rescued every once in a while.
Absolutely.
You know what I really sense acutely in the book is Denise's isolation. And she seems to be isolated amid all this high-tech world that we're living in.
Right.
You make that so clear, and you write that so beautifully. She's watching all this TV. She's totally tuned into all this stuff. And she seems so isolated and afraid and alone.
She does seem lonely, and I think that she has, she does have, I think she ends up in a better place than where she begins. I think she's more at peace with everything.
Partly
what the book is about. I think she needs to, it's not that she's doing anything wrong. She's lived a responsible life in a lot of ways. She's taken care of all the people that she loves.
Right,
she has
right.
a daughter. She has some good things. But she needed to figure out her relationship to the world.
Yeah,
more.
She hasn't taken care of herself.
Exactly.
And you see that so often in this culture, especially with women.
Especially middle-aged women. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Absolutely.
When your child is flown the coop and you're sort of left with whatever, or, you know, and she's, so I think that she's reconciling herself with, and I think also she's just reaching maturity about life being finite, about watching your parents age. I mean, it was my own experience of watching my parents age,
mm-hmm.
and just that feeling that you actually, I mean, I think this is what middle age means, is that you realize that you have, that actually you have a lot of hard times coming up. Watching parents age and then watching yourself age and experiencing that. And that's a different feeling. When you're 25, you think the good times are yet to come.
Oh, I know, and they're going to keep rolling.
Yeah, and then you get to that age and you sort of think, oh, no, things are probably going to get worse from here.
Oh, Dana.
But then you make your peace with it, and you sort of understand about...
Well, you make it into art.
You make it into
you
art.
You make it into art.
And you realize that's coming to terms with the main thing that you're here to come to terms with, which is the finite quality of your aspect of your life.
That's right. That's right. Now, do you think in any way that Nick was a coward not to want to share himself with the world, or was he selfish?
Well, sure.
What do you think about that? Because I think he was. I almost felt like it was a bit of a cop-out a few times. You know,
sure.
I understood it, but...
Yeah, I think he is, but I also think the people who are good at creating things are not always the people who are good at putting themselves out in the world and promoting.
Uh-huh.
He kind of needed to promote. He needed a manager, a promoter. I think these days artists are expected to do all of that. They're expected to have have this kind of great business media sense as well as create art. And I just don't see those two things as going together all that often.
I know. I've had so many artists on who've said they've had to literally learn how to sell themselves, because they never thought that. They thought they'd be able to sit in their studios and do the creating or whatever medium it is. And they've had to learn how to be promoters and business people.
Yes,
and it doesn't seem fair.
No, and part of this book is about my little tantrum about that. Because...
I know it is.
Because I think it used to be different. I think people were not expected to be. I mean, there's something also kind of precious about the artist who doesn't think that they have to taint themselves with commerce either. I mean, as I said, I feel multiple ways about things. That's why I can only be a novelist.
yeah. No, I understand that. I kept hoping in the book, too, that Denise would tell him to get a life.
Well,
and I'm not going to take care of you anymore. And, you know, I really wanted her to go take care of herself more in some
way. Well, she does kind of tell him at one point.
Yeah, she does, but she doesn't really.
She doesn't really follow
through with that.
Which is the way it usually works.
It is the way it usually works.
It is. I've tried to do that tough love thing, and it's almost impossible with a family member. It really is.
Yeah. This novel is very interesting to me because it does touch on the fact that so many people do seem isolated. And not everybody wants to be a star, you know. I mean, not everybody. Look what happened to Whitney Houston. People cannot handle
right. What
we expect of them. 24 hours a day, people have got their cameras out and their
That's
phones.
Horrifying.
They're taking pictures of people constantly.
No, it's not very interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's worth it for a lot of people. And I don't know if it's the best thing for some people.
Yeah.
So maybe he was doing the right thing for himself. And I think Denise, she made her choices. She chose to be his fan and his supporter, and I think that she got a lot out of it, And I think it's just hard to not have a lot of money. Neither one of them have a lot of money,
yeah.
And to grow old. This is a culture where the economics are very tough.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you want to be a bohemian and you want to live on the fringe, you pay the price when you get older. And that's something I've seen in friends of mine. Who have, been producing their whole lives and have tried, and they get to be middle-aged, and they don't have health insurance, they don't have a retirement plan. It's tough. I mean, we don't have a culture that really supports eccentricity or bohemian lifestyle.
No, and there are countries in Europe that do. The Netherlands, they support artists.
Yeah.
And that is really different. Now, you teach creative writing.
Mm.
Can we talk a little bit about
sure.
how you inspire your students and what attributes you think you should stress in people who want to become writers?
Well, I think with the students, I teach in the MFA program. So the students we get there are wonderful writers. It's a very competitive program.
Oh, yeah.
So I try not to get in their way. And we mostly talk about I talk about my own practice and I learn from them and they learn from me. And I also teach undergraduates, and that's very different. Those are novice writers.
Uh-huh.
And that is really just, talking about reading fiction and reading stories. And the thing that's amazing to me is that people used to read, my daughter is learning to read now. She has gotten bitten by the reading bug, and she never stops reading now.
Mm, that's great.
And I think a lot of kids are like that. And then they kind of lose it. They get distracted. And I think just getting the undergraduates back to when they were readers, because that's really how you learn about fiction, by reading. Yes, mm-hmm. It's experiencing life, but it's reading.
Yeah.
So it's a lot
yeah.
about learning how to read, actually. Reading carefully, looking at sentences and looking at language and how the writer, what decisions the writer's making and there are actual things that you can pay attention to that you can learn. Now, will it make you a great writer? No, but it could make, it can make you a pretty good writer, and it could make you, if you have it in you, it could make you a great writer if you have the will and the desire and whatever you call talent, it could. But I mean, there are technical things that you can learn and ways of reading that I don't think a lot of undergraduates have yet. Because we're not a reading culture any longer.
No, we're not. It's really, I despair at that. I really despair. Dana, we're almost out of time. Are you working on anything new you can tell us about?
I do. I am working on a new novel, but I can't. It's still my secret till
it's
I publish
your secret.
It.
Okay. And maybe you won't publish it.
Maybe
you'll,
maybe I'll never
you'll
publish
write fake
again.
Reviews. And let us
give my last interview.
Dream of your next novel. How about some contact information?
Oh, I do have a website. My technological, yes, I have at danaspiota.com, and you can email me there.
Okay. Well, Dana Spiota, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Stone Arabia. It's a wonderful book. Go out and read it. Thank you so much,
Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.